You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After the Cold War ended, America was left as the world's only remaining superpower, but the invasion of Iraq in 2003 may have seriously damaged the United States' standing. In his latest book, DiLapiro argues that as U.S. power wanes, a new world order is emerging. After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World is published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings DiLapiro back to our show today. Hello. Was the bipolar world during the Cold War so unusual? Hasn't Europe usually been split by into two competing alliances?
The bipolar world was actually, shall I say, a freak insofar as before 1945 to 1991, we never had this kind of ideological blocks facing each other in a clear-cut fashion of confrontation. Before that, the world was, in a way, multipolar. If we, let's say, talk about Europe. In Europe, as you know, after the Napoleonic Wars in 1815-16, when Napoleon almost captured Moscow, the rulers of the big powers then, which will be Tsarist Russia, Austro-Hungarian Empire, France, Spain, Britain, and Ottoman Turks, they said, we will never allow Napoleon type to rise up again. And therefore, they started to have friendships and enmities ever-changing. And that balance of force stayed on from 1818 to 1918, World War I. So this idea of multipolarity is not new. Europe had a multipolar world for 100 years. Now what I'm talking about in my book is that model on a worldwide scale.
Well, what about the unipolar situation that we had after the end of the Cold War when the United States was the only remaining superpower? Was that a unique situation?
No, not really. I think the whole idea of superpower itself, if I can put it this, becoming redundant. I mean, you can see right now, if today's headline, the New York Times, you know, that huge deficit for the U.S., 10.6% of the GDP, which is basically still a peacetime. Of course, the U.S. is not at war like in World War I, World War II, and so the idea of one superpower and its currency to be the primary reserve currency like Britain had in the 19th century, that idea has already been eroded away.
But for a while it looked like it was the way, wasn't it? After the Soviet Union fell, did the United States handle its power as the only remaining superpower well? We were militarily the most powerful country in the world. And weren't we also economically and technologically on top?
No, I think there are basically four dimensions to power: military, economic, political, diplomatic, and social, cultural, which you may call soft power. Now, if you take military, the lesson that we have learned from Iraq and Afghanistan is the limitation of military power. You know, Pentagon has put together the most lethal war machine ever put together by human beings. But they were, in a way, almost stopped or, you know, brought to a standstill with IEDs, improvised explosive devices. Okay, and that's asymmetrical warfare. And then we have to go one step forward. Next war is going to be cyber warfare. You know, you see the headline, Google and China, et cetera, you know, about censorship. That's immaterial. Mainly why people in the White House and the Pentagon and Foggy Bottom are having sleepless nights, because Chinese were able to break the code of Google. See, and that means, you know, to have 1,000 tanks or advanced aircraft, they become incidental.
So hackers are going to be the generals of the future?
No, certainly. Of course, you know, having power in what you may call, see, the Pentagon's idea, if you have an adversary, use overwhelming power. Okay, they did this in Iraq. They found it's a limitation to that, okay? But so I think there are two things. One is about the military, what we think. And you see, the point of a cyber warfare is that you don't know exactly who started it. You can't pinpoint, and you don't know when it finishes. And if you are cyber warfare, your water won't flow in your, you would not have no drinking water. There'd be no electricity, okay? But you see, that is only military. When it comes to economic power, of course, do I have to say what's the, which country or which mega nation is pulling the rest of the world out of recession? China, China. Mm-hmm. That role used to be played by Uncle Sam, no longer.
Now, empires have risen and fallen throughout history. Do you think that we would have seen this decline even if President Bush hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003?
Yeah, I think, you see, this is the trajectory of all empires. All empires, including the British Empire, of which you can say I am one of the sons of the British Empire because India was, you know, ruled by the British.
And now you live in England.
Yes. You know, see, British Empire went on, for more than one century. Okay, all empires, knowingly or unknowingly, overextend themselves. And if you ask me, what did Bush do? Bush overextended himself into Iraq, you see.
And well, why didn't Vietnam have the same effect on the United States? Because that was also an overextension, wasn't it?
So, why is that? Sorry?
Vietnam.
About Vietnam?
Yeah, Vietnam didn't have the same impact on States and its standing in the world as Iraq has.
Yeah, sure. I think Vietnam, again, was an extension, except that the economy of the U.S. hadn't reached the point one. Secondly, the Soviet economy in the 70s got gridlocked. Because, see, as long as the Soviet economy was at the low levels, and then they got to the point when they had 250,000 products in the Soviet system, and all the prices of 250,000 objects, products, had to be determined by people sitting in Moscow. I mean, that simply doesn't work, you see. So, I mean, that means the adversary had more problems than the USA.
We've talked a lot about the decline of the American car industry as an example of these changes. But now Toyota, one of the most, I guess, the number two car manufacturer in the world, is suffering greatly because of its accelerator pedals getting stuck.
Can you raise the volume here? The volume is here.
Are you hearing better now?
Yeah, sure.
Isn't this a problem that everybody has to deal with at different times? Suddenly we have Japan now faced with serious problems because of its technology not working well.
Yeah, sure. Of course, you know, these problems do come up, you see. But actually, as I said, if you want to stay a superpower, again, that was a unique situation, sole superpower. I would say that happened from 1992 because Soviet Union collapsed December 91, January 1992, up to what I easily remember, 080808. That is August 8, 2008. What happened on that day? On that day, Georgia's president said, I am going to get back the breakaway province of South Ossetia. He had his army attack the capital of South Ossetia. And on that day, George W. Bush was in Beijing Olympics. So was Mr. Putin. And when that particular thing happened, I mean, there's a wonderful, wonderful quote, which, I mean, it's a single-line quote, and it's my favorite, which says, this is the reaction of George W. Bush. Bullying and intimidation are not acceptable ways to conduct foreign policy in the 21st century, unquote, George W. Bush. Oh, okay, he said that.
Many people saw it as ironic.
But did he send a single soldier to help Georgian president? No. And that, if you ask me, that's the turning point when the military power of America showed its limitation.
But during the time that the period after the fall of the Soviet Union and the time you're talking about, the United States got involved in Panama, Somalia, Haiti, the former Yugoslavia. Were those military or diplomatic successes?
Absolutely. See, this is what I call, you know, the chapter heading for that is actually America's place in the sun. You know, oh yes, from that period, you know, until 2008, August, that was where America basically got what it wanted through the United Nations. And when they knew they would not get into the United Nations, as in Serbia, they ignored it and used NATO. And talking of cyber warfare, I should bring this in. NATO hacked the computer system of Serbia before bombing it, so they were the first one to actually make use of cyber warfare in 1999. So it won't be anything new if the Chinese do the same thing.
When the United States started looking to NATO to further its goals during the 90s, did that hurt its standing at the United Nations?
Yes, certainly. I think, you know, I mean, the early indications, you know, I'm not talking 1999, even in Serbia, they knew that they would not get the okay from Security Council, and Russia will veto it. So they ignored it and went ahead and did it. But I think Iraq really was the breaking point. Why? Because not only Russia and China were against invading Iraq, France and Germany. In Germany, you know, Gerhard Schroeder, he fought his election basically at anti-American stance. And won.
And Americans were furious. That's why we stopped eating French fries and started eating freedom fries. Dilip Hero is here. His latest book, After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World, is published by Nation Books. Was President George W. Bush's approach to diplomacy evident from the very start of his presidency? For example, he decided to pull the United States out of the anti-ballistic treaty in 2001. That's before 9/11, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm wondering whether we shouldn't have understood that we would go in the direction we did, whether there was a 9/11 or not, because there were certain signs already.
No, I think actually, as you know, the game plan of the Bush administration before 9/11 was to confront China. Because, you know, Wolfowitz and his guru at the Chicago University had said, conceive of the enemy who is rising and get rid of it or capture it now before it becomes the proper enemy. And China was going to be the one, you know, they are going to gun for.
And how are they going to do that?
No, of course, you see, then 9/11 came, then, of course, you know, they got off to another ball game. And even there, as you must know, that if you are talking Afghanistan, Kabul fell on 12, 13 November, but Kandahar fell only 7, 8 December. But on the third week of November, Rumsfeld, pressured by Bush, said to Tommy Franks, Central Command commander, where is the plan to attack Iraq? Where is the plan to attack Iraq? So already they had made up their mind to attack Iraq, which was a great folly.
Well, how damaging was the invasion of Iraq itself compared with what followed, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib? Some people see Abu Ghraib really as the moral tipping point and the thing that turned world opinion away from the United States.
Absolutely. I think, of course, when I said earlier the four dimensions, I did mention social cultural power, i.e. is moral power. You know, America believes in rule of law, America is a moral authority, etc., etc. And when these prisoners and their torture came through in a very dramatic way, then, of course, America lost its standing. And if we, you know, before Bush left White House, the Pew Research Group, they did a worldwide survey. 19% people in Europe approved of Mr. Bush, 19%. So I think on the whole, America lost out not only in terms of it was basically strategic defeat in Iraq, but also morally its standing went down very steeply.
Well, we talk about Europe. What was our standing in India, for example?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting you say, because, you know, after Obama became president, Pew again did a worldwide research. They found in Europe, approval rating for Mr. Obama was 76%, four times more. But in all other countries like China, India, Arab world, it's about the same, because the people there said, we say, where is the beef? We want to see action from Mr. Obama, not simply words.
Although in India we don't eat beef, but that's another matter. Dilip Hero's book, After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World, is published by Nation Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Dilip Hero, who has written many books, including the history of the Iran-Iraq War called The Longest War, also Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, Blood of the Earth. He contributes regularly to the New York Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, The Observer, The Nation, Los Angeles Times, Salon, and Tom Dispatch. He's been a commentator for CNN and the BBC. And he has written a new book called After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World, which is published by Nation Books. Why do you write that cutting taxes during the Bush administration contributed to the erosion of American power?
Yeah, I think, see, it's very interesting. Two adversaries, which is Bush and his team, and the bad guy, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, both in their own ways have tried to defy gravity. In the case of Bush, everybody knows you are fighting a war, so you raise taxes to fund the war and have partial or full draft. I mean, this has been since the days of the Greeks, okay? And then if you go to the other side, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, if you have insurgency only succeeds when the population at large is friendly. See, there have been five major insurgencies since World War II, and the one which did not succeed was in Malaysia or Malaya, because most communists were ethnic Chinese. Ethnic Chinese are a minority. Now, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they are, of course, putting on the bombs and so on. They are functioning in a country where 60% people are Shiites. And they are attacking Shiites, calling them snakeheads. Now, how do you expect that in a country where you are opposed to 60% of the population, that your insurgency will take off? So both on the completely different parts of the spectrum have tried to defy gravity, but the gravity ultimately gets you. And, of course, one of the main reasons for this bubble bursting in 2008 is these two wars going on without cutting taxes, you see. And that, of course, I understand about subprime mortgages, which I cover in my book, but this was the major reason. And ultimately, I should say, fortunately, it happened towards the end of Bush's term. Otherwise, all the blame would have been put on his successor.
But although there still are attempts to do just that, do we tend to underestimate the importance of economic power in comparison to diplomatic or military power?
No, I think, see, political diplomatic power follows. Take the example of the United States of America. United States became the number one industrial power just on the eve of World War I. 1913, it was the power. And by the end of World War II, 1946, it projected its power throughout the world. It became a superpower. So economics is the foundation. On that, you have a superstructure, which is political, diplomatic. Right now, which country is building up the foundation? China.
And the current recession is, you're saying, accelerating the diplomatic decline of the United States?
Yeah, I think, again, this is a comparative thing. Let's take the example of climate change conference in Copenhagen. Which country was out there and which country basically got its way? China. China had its own agenda. Of course, when previously unknown or previously non-major power achieves its first success, then naturally the established power says, oh, bad guys, they are showing the dragon is showing its teeth and so on and so forth. I mean, that kind of reaction shows they did quite well, China.
On the other hand, what they were pushing for isn't all that commendable. The Chinese leader, Hu Jintao, said last year that, I'm quoting, despite its severe impact on China's economy, the current financial crisis also creates opportunity for the country. So isn't he hurt by the fact that people don't have the spending power they did before and won't buy as many Chinese products?
No, surely. But I think, you see, again, this particular financial crisis affected China, and so far the exports dropped. But then what they have done, because in the past they did not have enough consumption at home, so they are actually now throwing money at people to, say, buy cars and so on and so forth. As you know, last year China produced 13 million cars and light trucks, and U.S. only produced 10.3 million. So they're already ahead in it. So there is enough leeway, because, you see, though China is very powerful, has a lot of money, but in GDP per capita, China is 104 in the list of 192 countries. So they are still middle power in that sense. The one very interesting thing, see, in Beijing, they have the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, which has 4,000 scholars and researchers, 80% of whom have been abroad. And they came up with what is called a comprehensive national power, CNP. And CNP has 64 different factors, and all of them are quantified. And the last figure I could get for 2006, you know, they say in 2006, America had, out of 100, 90.26 power. And China had only 59.03. India had 50.1, and Russia had 63 point something. So what I mean is that those people who are running the show in China, they are very realistic. They understand that we are not, and nor do they believe that we push America down and then we become number one. They don't believe in that. They believe in multipolarity.
Although China will become the world's second largest economy, can it serve as a viable economic model to the developing world? Are there other states that are going to be using it as a model? In the same way that the Soviet model was attractive to smaller states during the Cold War.
I think what China is doing, actually, see, the whole world is basically capitalist. Okay? China is state-directed capitalism. See, I mean, if you take banking, the reason they are doing well, despite the financial crisis all over the world, except India, because in China, banking is controlled 100% by the state. In India, which is dearly loved by people who live in the United States, the world's largest democracy, there, in India, 75% of banking is nationalized. That's the reason why they have 7.7% GDP, because you control the banking system. So I think essentially what it is this. When the Soviet Union was a part of the bipolar world, then the Soviet model was a socialist model, which is a different civilization. Blah, blah. Now, Chinese don't have a different civilization. At the same time, they have one-party system, and the Communist Party has not remained static. It's changed, okay? And this state-directed capitalism, I think this has attraction for quite a few African countries.
But there are many African countries with one-party systems that are economic disasters.
No,
look,
sure.
Look at Zimbabwe.
No, of course, Zimbabwe, there are, of course, you know, what you may call rogue states, and so certain, there are dictators. I mean, then if you look at the Middle East, tell me, other than Iran, where do you, and Lebanon, where do you have elections, you know, even in Egypt?
And in Iran, if you protest the results of elections, it seems now you face the likelihood of being executed.
No, yes, certainly, of course. But then again, if, see, if my coffee cup now is half full or half empty, you know, now you can tell me which country in the Middle East has a system whereby the incumbent president is facing a challenger for 90 minutes on TV, watched by 50 million people. That happened last time. See, they got overconfident, or never mind. So there are different ways of looking at it. But I think that in terms of model, as you said, China already has established, you know, shall I say, areas of influence in Africa, in Nigeria, in Tanzania, and so on. And when it comes to elections, what they are basically saying, I summarize there, there's a whole chapter on democracy. What they are saying, the elections do not necessarily, they can be very corrupting. You know, Obama's election campaign and all that, it cost $1 billion. My figure is that for one single vote, he spent $14.
My guest is Dilip Hero. His book, After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World, it's published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Abu Ghraib, as you say, really hurt the United States' image. Why hasn't China's serious human rights problems been as damaging? I mean, there's a big campaign now by Penn to make a jailed author the next Nobel Prize winner in literature. They just executed a scientist, and they're jailing lawyers who are defending people who obviously need legal defense. It doesn't seem to be having the same kind of negative impact.
I think what happens, you see, again, if one takes China's one-party state, there's a big difference. I mean, I just want to illustrate that there are incremental changes which don't make a headline. I give you specific examples, which, of course, I have in my book. 1949 Communist Revolution, Communist Party was the vanguard party of the toiling masses. Under Jiang Zemin, who was before Hu Jintao, they said Communist Party represents all classes of people, including capitalists. I mean, they don't just say capitalists. They say non-state entrepreneurs, non-state, okay? I mean, okay, they have their own problems, okay? So that's one. Secondly, they wanted to pass a labor law. And they invited, there were something like 10,000 different hearings, and people sent their comment on, et cetera, okay? Thirdly, about 10 years ago, they passed, they meaning, you know, through Parliament, the Communist Party passed the law that if you as a citizen think that the government agent has destroyed your property or done something to you, you can take the government to court. You know, and more importantly, until now, almost all of the so-called judges were party members. But now up to 40% of judges are qualified judges. They are not party members. So what I'm saying is there's incremental change within the party and giving more and more rights to citizens against the state, et cetera, all of that is done at a level which doesn't make a headline.
Although they give with one hand and then take back with the other, I guess this is the problem when you're going through major changes. There's always somebody who says, let's go back to the old system. Let's be as tough as possible.
No, honestly, I think that's another interesting thing about China. If you compare the Chinese Communist Party with the Soviet Communist Party, you see big differences. Whatever they are doing in China, take the Deng's economic reform. He came up with the idea of a special economic zone, SEZ. But he only allowed four economic zones in 1980. It was only in 1992 they started expanding. Basically, what are they always doing? They try things on a smaller scale. If they work, they do it. Now, right now, there are elections at the village level elections, but villages don't have power.
Now, there are two other major areas that we have to consider. Russia, which has been largely dependent on oil for its economic fortunes, and as oil prices go down, Russia suffers. Can we call it an emerging nation? And then the other, of course, is the EU, which really was hurt by the recession, but seems to be recovering in ways perhaps a little quicker than the United States is.
Yeah, I think I'll take Russia first. This is interesting because even though, of course, you know, it's no longer like the Soviet Union, but the fact that Russia has as many nuclear bombs, et cetera, as the Pentagon, that makes it, in a way, the major power because they have destructive power. Okay, mm-hmm. Of course, when it comes to conventional war and army, they are no match. And that's why they're very keen not to have anti-missile defense, you know, around their perimeter. Okay, that's one thing. Secondly, this is something worth remembering. Of course, you hear Putin talking about what they call sovereign democracy. And, of course, the Western world says this is managed democracy. Two things. One, that particular constitution, according to which sovereign democracy is written in the preamble, was written by one and only Boris Yeltsin when he was sober, which was not often, but he wrote the whole thing.
But you have evidence that he was sober that day.
No, but I think, you know, he was supposed to allow Duma to draft it, but he rushed the whole thing. If Putin is actually following that constitution, you shouldn't blame him. You should blame Boris, because in that constitution, he gave more power to president and less to parliament. That's mm-hmm. one. Okay. More importantly, see, we talk about liberal democracy, capitalism, etc. All of that is rooted into the split in the Roman Catholic Church, Protestant and Protestant Protestantism and capitalism took off, because under the Catholic Church you couldn't receive interest, for example. Okay, so Reformation, Enlightenment, all and a split in the church is very germane to our idea of liberal democracy and capitalism. The Orthodox Church of Russia did not split. They did not have Reformation. They did not have Enlightenment. And to have a strong executive from the Tsar to Lenin, then Stalin. Okay, so therefore, on the whole, Russians like to have a strong executive leader. I mean, even as the prime minister, Putin gets 70 to 80% approval rating. So this is, you know, all of these are very important factors to keep in mind. It's no use saying, ah, you're not doing what we are doing. I mean, that is what you may call cultural hegemony.
Now, just 1 minute. Russia, I mean, Europe, which has as much buying power as the United States, the EU, and pretty much the same population, right?
No, no, more than 500, 480 million.
So it's very spotty. Some countries are troubled, Spain, Italy. But on the whole, the EU seems to be recovering because they have more controlled economies?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you read the speeches by President Sarkozy, you think, you know, this is a born-again Marxist. You know what I mean?
And he's the conservative in French politics, ran against the socialists.
When he gave the keynote speech at Davos last week, he said, dollar should no longer be the primary reserve currency. And he himself said the days of one power telling us what to do are gone. And this capitalism has gone haywire, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But if you take the European Union, a good example, as an economic power, they are the largest trading entity in the world. But they are not able to transform this into politics because there is no political single identity. 27 countries, different backgrounds, for them to have one unified view of themselves is very difficult.
And the Parliament, European Parliament, has not really unified them in any way.
Yeah, I think they are making progress, but they will never be able to transform. See, in a way, what I said earlier, that economic, they build on that. But as long as you have a single political entity like China, like India, that's fine. But if you have 27 countries mishmashed together, and European Union is a strange animal. It's not a federation. It's not a confederation. It is something in between. You know, and what it is, I don't know. I plead innocence.
Dilip Hero's latest book is After Empire, The Birth of a Multipolar World. It is published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.